My name is John Freeman. I'm the U.S. editor of Fanta, and I'm also a board member of this bookstore. And before we start, I just wanted to say a little bit about the space that you're sitting in. Housing Works is a nonprofit, and all the books that you see around you, and including the books for tonight's event, were donated by individuals and publishers. And the proceeds from the sales of those books go to Housing Works programs for homeless New Yorkers with HIV and AIDS, and it helps them provide job training, get some housing. And so it's a great place to come and donate books, have a coffee, hear a reading. So thank you for coming out tonight, because you have all become activists by being here. And I'm extraordinarily thrilled to have with us tonight Joseph O'Neill and Jonathan Leatham, two writers who I think and believe in my heart have written classic New York novels, Motherless Brooklyn and Netherland, but they're also the authors of many other books, and they've also contributed to Granta's latest issue, which is themed on fathers, which we'll be talking about and reading from tonight. For those of you who have not studied their bios or their author photographs, Jonathan is also the author of four other collections of short fiction and nonfiction work, and nine novels, including the forthcoming
Chronic City,
thank you, which is coming in September. And Joe is the author of three novels and a memoir, Blood Dark Track, which we'll probably be talking about somewhat tonight. But before we leap in and I ask them to read from and talk about their pieces on fathers, I wanted to speak very briefly about someone who I think a lot of writers and readers in the room, some men, maybe some women as well, think of as a kind of literary father, who is John Updike, who sadly died today at the age of 76. So at this point, I will turn it over to Joe and to Jonathan to say just a few words about what his work and figure meant to them as writers.
Can you hear me? John Updike. In the UK paperback edition of my new novel, Netherland, they have a kind of what they call a PS section, and that includes slight kind of bonus materials for the reader. And it includes a very short interview with me in which I'm asked, you know, who's your favorite living writer? And I said, John Updike. Well, that's now been overtaken by today's news. It's appropriate in a way to have, as John said, the question of Updike arising in the context of fathers, because he is a sort of literary father to me, and I think to many readers and writers. We've only written with him around, and I think we've never known what it is to read or to write without having John Updike there. And it's not simply the example of his writing, of his fiction, which is, I think, impresses itself upon someone who tries to write prose, but also the knowledge that there existed in the world this rather sort of sublime intelligence that was revealed in his criticism, which sort of monitored it with a sort of equanimity and insight which never faltered the efforts of writers other than himself. And so one always, at least in my case, I always sort of wrote with the subconscious or conscious knowledge that, you know, who knows? Updike might read this, and who knows? I don't think he'd approve of this bit, so I might have to rewrite that again. So there was this kind of exalted intelligence and authority in a way. And I'm not sure that now that he's died, that there is someone else to whom one can look so readily for that kind of paternal presence. And so it's with a real sense of bereavement that I heard the news today.
I'm glad you went first, because that was such a nicely complete. It frees me to just kind of work around the edges a little bit. I mean, it is this sort of titanic presence that's gone, and I'm very grateful to Joseph for mentioning the criticism, because his constant voice and the sense that he was so reading so much, still cared so much about what was occurring in fiction, in literature, was daunting but very, very inspiring. I grew up reading him. He's a very basic part of the landscape, and it's funny because one of the things I was coming here thinking I would talk about, I saw this remark recently that the long lives of artists are changing, and writers are changing the nature of their own careers and of artistic traditions, because you get more late work now, and that's changing quite a lot about the way we end up looking at writers. And Updike, obviously, he would have gone on giving us a lot of late work because he was unstoppable, but he gave us a lot as it is. But this also comes to bear on writers writing or talking about, as we'll do tonight, their fathers, because I think so many earlier generations of novelists might handle family material mostly after parents are gone, and the long lives of our parents mean that we have this alternate environment where, like the writers we revere growing up, who are still around, our parents are often still around. I'm becoming a middle-aged writer myself, and it's only now that this generation that I saw kind of looming like parents over the world of writing, Mailer and Updike and others are some of them leaving the scene. I mean, it does change the way you think and the way you feel about what's out there. But I'll say just two more very quick things about Updike. One is, he inspired one of the finest books about a writer by another writer that I know of, a book I absolutely revere called You and I by Nicholson Baker. And something about Updike's own generosity that seems to open up this space where Nicholson Baker's tribute becomes possible. And so it's absolutely to his credit. And the other thing, and this is just an impossible story not to tell, the last time, and one of only two times that I ever saw Updike in the flesh, I never was introduced to him. I once went to see him speak. The second time was September 11th, 2001, when after hours suffering the slavery of the television, the group of people I had been with in Borough Hill suddenly realized that we wanted to leave the house, and the only idea about leaving the house was twofold, was to go to the promenade and look at things with no mediation. But on the way, we'd been told that you were to give blood. Of course, this was a fantasy. There was no place for the blood to go, and there was no one to take the blood. But this idea circulated. Some of you will remember this. And the local destination, we were told, was the Brooklyn, I think it's a Hyatt on Adams Street, on the way down from the Brooklyn Bridge. And the lobby of this place was swarming with people who'd all been told to go there, to arrive there, to give blood. And we were all eventually to be told it was meaningless attempt, or that it wasn't going to work, and we all dissipated. But one of the people who'd rushed there, and I saw him there, having come, I think, from Brooklyn Heights, the other direction, was John Updike, just looking ashen and as you'd expect, but he, having just had this exact same human impulse at the exact same moment that I and my friends had it, and of course was impossible to break the spell of that moment and greet him or just do anything except just note in a strange, abstracted way that there he was, but it comes to mind today.
A funny story, two stories about Updike, and then we'll jump into the fathers. One, a friend of mine at Knopf said that whenever John Updike published a book, he would sign it from I to you and send it to Nicholson Baker. And I suppose that Widows of Eastwood was the last one. And the second story is I interviewed John Updike a few times, one of which was when he published Still Looking, which is a book of art criticism, and I went up to the Boston Museum to look at paintings that were in the book that he had described with him, and sort of get him to riff in real time. So we're walking around, and this woman strolls up to him and says, "Excuse me, aren't you John Updike?" And he turns around and says, "Yes, I am." And he sort of does this whole thing and talks to her. After she strolls off, he says, "You going from..." What did he say? He said, "One goes from being looking to being looked at." And then on the world with the interview. And the funny thing is, I had just come from divorce court. And I was 2 hours divorced when I started this interview. So I came there in a ragged shirt with ripped jeans and a hangover, looking like shit. And John Updike is not someone you want to appear to looking like you just rolled out of bed. But he was very nice and he didn't say anything. We were strolling around. And I think at some point in the middle of the interview, I sort of started to flag. And he said, Kathy says, "You've come down from Vermont. Is it a long trip?" I said, "Oh, and actually, I was coming from Maine." He said, "What were you doing there?" And I said, "Actually, I was getting divorced." The interview comes to this screeching halt. And oh, God. And then he proceeded in, you know, a few sentences, as Updike really could, just told me this little story and gave me a piece of advice, none of which I captured on my recorder. And that was that, and went back into the interview. And that was sort of the person he was. Incredibly genial, a real gentleman, but also the thing that his fiction did, at least I'm sure you guys experienced this, is he was so autobiographical as a writer. He was out there in front of you as a way of experiencing things in front of you, much as fathers do, except there was this incredible, minutely detailed record of those experiences. So in some ways, I think writers of your generation and my generation and younger live vicariously through his fiction. On that note, I would like to turn it over to Joe and Jonathan and have one of you start by reading your father's piece, Branta, which are, I think, terrific.
Can I start? My father is living. He's not here. He thought about coming down from Maine, but didn't manage it. I'll flash this picture, you won't all be able to see it, but there's the photograph that I'm writing about, and I took this invitation very much as a chance to write directly about the photograph, which, like a parent, is itself a kind of mysterious object in my life. It's been around for a while. The picture floats. Someone took it in the 70s, but the white backdrop gives no clue. My dad owned that wide lapel trench coat for 15 or 20 years. Typical thrifty child of the Depression. In parentheses, he probably tried to give it to me at some point. The beard's trim narrows the time frame slightly, that rakish full goatee. So often in later years, he wouldn't have bothered to shave his jaw to shape it. So put this in the early 70s. Somehow it floated into my collection of paper trinkets, ferried off to college, then to California for a decade, the only copy. By the time I showed it to my father last week, he hadn't seen the photograph for 30-odd years. He couldn't be sure of the photographer. Guessing it, three friends with comically overlapping names, Bobby Ramirez, Bob Brooks, and Jeff Brooks. I remember all three of these guys, beloved rascals from my parents' hippie posse. He settled at last on Jeff Brooks. The picture was never framed, nor mounted in an album, just shifted from file cabinet to cardboard box to file cabinet all this time. A scrap of scotch tape on the left corner reminds me that I had it taped up over a desk in Berkeley. In a family that, after my mother's death, scattered itself and its memorabilia to far corners of the planet and reassembles now sporadically and sloppily, this picture's a survivor. I've lived with it for 30 years, gazed into its eyes as often, strange to say, as I have my father's living eyes. It shows Richard Leatham as I dream him, my idol, his Midwestern kindness, prairie gazer's soul, but come to the city, donning the beatnik garb, become the painter and poet and political activist he made himself, a man of the city. When I first knew my parents, they were, paradoxically, just the two most exciting adults on the scene, part of a pantheon of artists and activists and students staying up late around the dinner table and often crashing afterwards in the extra rooms of the house. My parents were both the two I had the best access to and the coolest to know, the hub of the wheel. I wasn't interested in childhood. I wanted to hang out with these guys. The picture shows my dad meeting the eyes of a member of his gang, both of them feeling their oats, knowing they were the leading edge of the world. I wanted him to look at me that way. He often did.
My piece is so slight that it barely exists, and it always takes about 10 minutes to find it in this. So here we are. I can't actually read this out loud because I haven't actually written anything coherent. What I've done instead is I've essentially made a list of all the jobs my father has worked and all the places which he's gone to. He's alive as well. In fact, I spoke to him this morning. And so I'm slightly at a loss about what to say now. But just to give you an idea, I can read the very first six lines. In 1958, when he was 19, my father, Kevin O'Neill, got a job with Chicago Bridge and Iron, an American corporation active worldwide in the construction of industrial plants, at Whitegate Refinery in Cork, which is my father's hometown. His subsequent career, mainly in hard hat managerial positions, yields this chronology. And then there's the chronology. So and there are some footnotes to the chronology. But basically, so he goes every year or every half year he moves. And my entire childhood, in other words, his career took him from Ginslark in Germany to Mersin, Turkey, to Schultzjahr, Denmark, to Ingolstadt, Germany, to Rotterdam, the Netherlands, to Neuchâtel, Switzerland, to Tehran, to Lissa, Cyprus, to Lebanon, to Umbongtwini, South Africa, to Matola, Mozambique, to Ras Lanuf, Libya, to Kermanshah, Iran, and this is where my memory starts to kick in, to Rotterdam, the Netherlands, to Abu Dhabi, to Porsgrunn in Norway, to Ohenish Island in Ireland, where I worked with him. And then after that, here's a bit of actual prose, which is capable of being read, I suppose, although I have to warn you, it's deadly dull. And it's the very dullness and listiness of this which actually interested me. I just wanted to recall what it means to work for 40 years and the amount of work my father did, always away from the house and always coming back intermittently with kind of magazines. We'd see him every 2 or 3 months, basically. And always kind of somehow sticking to the family, so it's remarkable, really. But anyway, this is what my father's life was like. Is like, he's still working. After Ohenish, this is in Ireland, my father left Chicago Bridge. He joined the Bechtel Corporation in 1982, went as a project manager to Balikpapan, Borneo, to build a refinery in the coastal jungle. There's a footnote. There are various footnotes to these things. Vijay's the footnote to the Borneo is that Vijay Singh, not long afterwards, became the pro at the local golf club. Vijay said, "It was the lowest point in my life." And then in 1984, he was sent as a field superintendent to Wales on a refinery job for Texaco. In 1985, he joined Wimpy Engineering. His first job was at Sullom Voe in the Shetland Islands, managing the shutdown of a gigantic refinery. From 1986 to 1990, he was resident manager at Fawley Oil Refinery. Then he joined John Brown Engineering and worked on the Celebon Phenelics project at Barry, South Wales. You know, Celebonics. You know that project. And then in Al Jubail, Saudi Arabia, on the Ibn Zahr polypropylene project and an industrial alcohol plant for Samat. He then went to Uppsala, Sweden as the project manager on a secondary pharmaceutical plant for Pharmacia and Upjohn. In 1997, he helped build the biggest silicon plant in the world in Barry, South Wales. The client was Dow Corning. In 2000, Kverna John Brown sent him to Dublin to build a Bristol-Myers Squibb primary pharmaceutical plant. In 2004, my father joined Tepe in Chart and was the project manager for building pump stations on the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline. So there you have it. In fact, that's the pipeline which runs, you know, from the capital. Where is Baku? What's the sea that Baku is on? The Caspian? And it runs through there all the way across various mountainous countries through down to southern Turkey. And I remember once getting a phone call from my father from Mount Ararat saying, "Hey, guess where I am, Joe? I'm on Mount Ararat." And he was very thrilled about that. He has 4 children and 11 grandchildren, 10 boys, 1 girl. He and my mother live in Turkey, which by chance is where they met 47 years ago when she was a secretary employed by Foster Wheeler. Their marriage still works.
Well, the thing that strikes me about these two pieces, which are very different, although the two of you were both born in 1964, your backgrounds couldn't be any more different, Jonathan. You're a total New Yorker, except for a brief interlude in Kansas City. Joe, you've lived everywhere, Turkey, Holland, here. Both of you have followed the form of your father's function in writing these pieces. Joe, your piece kind of reads almost like a construction bill, in a sense, of putting something together.
Okay, that's very kind of you.
I understood that to be on purpose, and I wondered if Jonathan, yours feels like a descriptive, as if it's trying to sort of write its way into a visual form. And I wondered if both of you thought about that before sitting down to write these pieces, or if that just happens naturally.
Well, I mean, I hadn't put it together the way you just described it, but I was very aware that the task of writing about my father, and especially writing only a page or two about my father, was by definition impossible, but that I could write about a photograph. And so I let myself write about the man I was looking at in the photograph and try to keep the response almost bounded by what the picture itself aroused. So I guess in that way I dealt with it as a kind of visual assignment, very definitely. Because I was raised in a painter's household and I trained as a visual artist for a long time, this is always a complicated question for me, because people will point to something about my writing that seems to them like visual art, and I never think that way first, but it must be there, of course.
The form of this, I just saw this as an opportunity to avoid writing complicated prose, and so I interviewed my father and got him to do all the work. So the piece, in fact, embodies the opposite of the work ethic which it describes. It embodies the non-work ethic. And after I got him to write it all down, I said, "Thank you very much," and I sent it off to Granta, and you know, they paid me. So it was, for me, it was like, it's basically, yeah, it sort of sums up the sort of unfortunate, I mean, the sort of admiration from an all too kind of opposite distance between of my father's work ethic and my own. I mean, the word, the piece such as it is, I mean, there are footnotes too, but no more interesting than what you heard, ends with the word works, and on the marriage, and I think the subtext of the piece is, you know, it's a snapshot of a life which is not a literary life, and it's not an urban life or a metropolitan life, and but it goes to the core of how I understand my father, which is a man who gets up early in the morning and goes to a patch of bare land in the mountains and the desert and the jungle, and only kind of surfaces once there's a sort of, you know, toxic pharmaceutical.
Well, both your fathers in some ways are builders. I mean, Jonathan, your father is making things constantly throughout his life, and Joe, your father's building plants and refineries, and both of them, Joe, I understood from your memoir, and Jonathan from Disappointment Artists, are extremely lively, colorful figures. Joe, your father punched out every window in the hotel owned by your maternal grandfather before having to go downstairs and meet her father for the first time. What sort of mental hydraulics happen when an editor calls you and says, by the way, we'd like you to write a piece on your father, and how do you sort of channel that?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's a lot of backstory to this moment. It doesn't begin with Granta for me, because I wrote very definite fictional fathers in a couple of books in a row, and they weren't him. They were involved enough in matters of being a son to a father or being a child of a father.
Did he ever ask you, is that me?
Well, no, we haven't ever talked about it that way, but I mean, the key, in a way, is that my father is himself an artist who combines observed elements with imagined ones. His canvases, his portraits of people, aren't strict resemblances. They're fantasias built on observation. And so I think that my own methods seemed very natural to him. He knew not to wonder that they might be simply him, but he also knew well enough what they had to do with him. And I'm talking about Girl and Landscape, and then The Fortress of Solitude. I sort of skipped a book with Motherless Brooklyn. I made my character an orphan, and it has a lot to do with fatherhood or the idea of parents, but it avoids portraying a real father-son or parent-child relationship directly. The thing about it is that there was a pressure that built up from doing this, and especially after The Fortress of Solitude, where I made a dad a painter in Brooklyn, then I started to want to set some facts in order, if only for myself. I mean, it was funny that for a while people would ask my father, how was his film coming along? And he's never done anything like that film in The Fortress of Solitude. And he's not very much like Abraham Edmonds, but the emotional transaction of the boy in that book and the father in that book has a lot to do with our emotional transactions. So I wrote that essay that you're mentioning in The Disappointment Artist, an essay called Lives of the Bohemians, sort of just to say, if you're wondering, and I am by now wondering in a way, this is what Richard Latham did do in his life. This is what kind of painter he actually was. To create a little triangulation between myself and these complicated, fictionalized fathers, and his own life. So I'd done this, I'd taken this jump, but it's the funny thing about that essay in Disappointment Artist is that I don't think it's one of the most complete or realized essays in that book or that I've ever done. And in fact, the only chance that my father ever had to hear me read from that, aloud from that book, and he loves that essay, he's very proud of the fact that it exists, but when he stood at risk for hearing me read it in public, he said, no, read the one about Cassavetes, I think it's much better written. And I think he's sort of right. I think that the problem of writing about a living father was not completely to be solved.
And it appeared in Modern Painters, which is sort of like stepping into his world. No?
Yeah. It was, actually the version in Modern Painters is much, has material that I didn't bother reproduce in the essay collection, because I kind of turned myself into a art writer for a moment there, something I never thought I wanted to do, but I tried to write about his work analytically. And then I looked at that part of the material and I just tossed it out completely and left in the family stuff. So I kind of tried to cross this bridge before and knew that I was only going to get halfway across. And that was okay. Somewhere between the failed essay and the fictional fathers, I was adequately satisfied. And so no knock on this page for granted, but it came as a kind of afterglow to this very complicated, transaction.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it is difficult to write about your father when he's alive, and I have a horrible feeling it's going to be very difficult to write about him once he's dead, which is a thought, obviously. One of the reasons I sort of sought refuge in this list was precisely to avoid having to write about my father. Well, at the same time, generating a text which enables me to appear here. Yeah. You know, if I really wanted to write about my father, I'd basically have to write about the two of us playing golf, and that would be. And in fact, there is a scene in my first novel, a very obscure first novel, in which one of the characters plays golf with his dad, who's kind of constantly telling him to keep his head still. Watches parts and all this kind of just irritating the hell out of him. And just as my father and I, our transactions are limited, not by emotion or love, but by form, really, to sort of intercontinental phone calls and golf games, essentially. That's what our relationship consists of. I sort of feel that I'm not ready to sort of write a portrait of it. It would be just too vast a subject.
But Jonathan, you talk in that essay, Disappointment Artist, about you became an artist and you broached this topic at age 15 with your father about having your own exhibition. Joe, did you go through a phase at all where you decided you wanted to become a builder of vast and poisonous refineries?
Well, I actually worked with my dad when I was 17. I finished high school, as it wasn't called where I was, and I went to Ireland where he was building this plant in Limerick, and I got a job as a GO, general operative. I felt like a completely useless person on the job site. It was this huge alumina construction site filled with thousands of men, and he sort of buried me in a garage where I had to sort of, but I did nothing. I was nominally the assistant to the mechanic and the electrician, so we would be fixing cranes all day. I mean, of course, I don't know anything about cranes or fixing them. But I do remember that the very first day I went to work, there was a sort of commotion at lunchtime, and everybody started leaving. And I said, well, what's happening? They said, we're hitting the gears. I said, what do you mean? He said, so we were on strike the very first day, I guess, my dad. And so I went home and I said to my dad, well, I'm on strike now, what do I do? And he said, well, you stay on strike. He said, we're not having any scabs in this house. And he also said, you're fired as well, by the way. So I did work with him. And the next day, we were all reinstated, and I spent 6 months or 7 months working for my dad. And I was actually quite impressed by him because he would sort of because he was the boss, he would sort of cruise in his car with his sunglasses on, and they would just cruise this enormous job site. And I remember one time there was this impossible problem with a hole in the ground and a crane and some load, and how to get the load up to the crane when the crane was stuck on the high level, and people sat around scratching their heads for about 10 minutes, saying, how do we fix this? And by chance, my dad sort of turned up with his sidekick in their glasses, really sort of like two kind of hoods. And they were sort of told, we've got an impossible problem, this multi-billion-dollar job, whatever it was, is ground to a halt because of this crane and the hole and the load. And I remember thinking, I just felt embarrassed for my dad. I said, my dad is never going to be able to fix this. He's going to be found out because that's my dad. But then, sure enough, he wanders up to the problem and he says, well, do this and then do that and do this, sort of rethinking the whole situation, and then wandered off again. And at that moment, I was in awe of my father for the first time, that he could actually fix the problem with the crane and the hole in the ground and the leg. So I did work with him. Yeah, but I never formed the ambition to follow in those footsteps.
But as a writer who's sort of reluctant to enter the vast subject of writing on your own father, I know you're a fan of Philip Roth. When you read books about fatherhood, books like that, or maybe John Edgar White's Father Along, and I know this is absolutely not a topic that's limited to men writing about their fathers, because there are several pieces in this issue, including a very good one by Siri Husfeld on her father. But what What do you think when you read those books, especially Patrimony, which I think is a phenomenal book? I mean, are you just sort of overwhelmed?
It's an unbelievable book of that. I mean, I think it's one of Roth's handful of very, very best books. And completely incredible. But I also think he worked towards that a long while. I mean, and it's funny, I was just flipping open Portnoy's Complaint, and there's this terrifying description of his father's penis. As this meaty hose that he's beholding from this great distance, like an ant on the ground before monstrous jungle creature. I think he had to visit a lot of different places in his own work and in his own writing about fathers before Patrimony might have been possible.
There's actually another description of his father's penis, surprisingly enough, in Patrimony when he's ill and he's bathing him. And he says, "Wow, Dad's got a big one. That's great." Yeah. And it's a totally different tone. You know, it's not describing it as this sort of colossus, you know, psychological weight.
Yeah. Roth is such...
Will you ever write by your dad's penis?
When Granta has a special issue on father's penis, it's all
come right up.
There won't be a photograph this time. I don't know. When I think about Patrimony, that's the kind of book anyone would just kill to have written. But I think that, you know, Roth in that phase of his work is the most extraordinary example of earned grace. I mean, he had to write a lot of tormented books and a lot of incomplete books, I think, in some ways, to suddenly, in his, I think that's at the start of his 60s, you know, have, you know, the greatest hot streak in the history of American fiction, writing, practically. So I'll cross my fingers.
Aside from Patrimony, Joe, are there books about fathers that you read and sort of marveled over that as a writer who's not keen on
reading?
No, exactly. That's a good result.
Really? I'm sure there are, obviously. What's that poem by Ian Cummings? My father moves through dunes of love, through halves of land, something like that. I can't remember the rest of it, which is a remarkable poem. I was actually hoping to sort of mention Patrimony in this context. What's that title about as well? I like the poems of Paul Muldoon on his father. He's written quite a lot about his father. You're exposing me to the kind of filial fraud that I am. Yeah, there are. The answer to your question, yes, there are many books I admire.
How did you guys pick these pictures? You probably had a lot to choose from, and I'm curious why you chose these specific ones. I think, John, you sort of explained it in your piece.
Yeah, it came to mind the minute the assignment came up. I wasn't sure I wanted to write anything, but I wanted this photograph somehow made. It was a way of giving it back to my father. In fact, he hadn't seen it. Just as I say, the piece, he didn't probably remember it existed. And he certainly, I saw him trying to reconstruct the occasion, even though it looks very posed. It's one of those amazing things that a photograph, for the person who possesses it, becomes this concrete object. But I never had any doubt. I mean, for another thing, one of the symptoms of the conditions in my family that I describe glancingly in that little page and describe much more extensively in something like Lives of the Bohemians is that at a certain point, my family stopped taking pictures. There aren't that many pictures to have or to consider. If I wanted pictures of him now, I could find a few. And if I wanted pictures of him marrying my mother holding me as a baby, there are those, but when my mother became ill and our family kind of unspooled, it's one of the things that goes away. There are very few pictures of me at certain ages. I don't know what, I couldn't find you very much evidence of what I looked like between, you know, 12 and 17, 18.
Joe, there's some pictures of your father in Blood Dark Track, including, I think, the picture of his wedding day.
Yeah.
But this is a very different picture.
Yeah, the picture in the Grotto is a picture of my dad in the desert in Libya, holding his, well, you'd have to, I mean, I hate describing visuals, but he's in the desert, and he's got a hard hat on, and I have to say, I didn't choose this picture. I chose to write about his work career, and I knew there was some in existence, there must be some picture of him wearing a hard hat, in the, you know, and so I sort of asked my, you know, brothers and sisters about whether or not they had a picture, and one eventually materialized. But I'm glad that Granta dug this picture up and sort of gave me a chance. I mean, it's slightly misleading because I think it's characterized as, the book is characterized as writers writing about their favorite pictures. But I'm quite prepared to make it my favorite picture now. And so retrospectively confer accuracy on that description of the of this picture, which I've now lost again. Because yeah, there he is with a mysterious bunny of his. I think pretty much in he's got, just to make things even more complicated, he's holding something in front of his face so you can't actually see his face because of the shadow. But he's certainly, you know, he's got a work gear on, he looks the part. And he's certainly at work. That's not a leisure outfit he's wearing. And in fact, he's not wearing a hard hat, his friend is. Which is unusual because my father is obsessed with hard hats because of, for the safety reasons. Yeah, and then in my last book, there's a picture of him getting married to my mother, he's pretty good.
He's a handsome
old devil. Yeah.
It makes me wonder. I mean, he seems about as far from a bookstore as he can possibly be in that photograph. And what is your father's attitude towards or relationship to your work? When you publish a book, what is he?
He's very, very proud. He reads everything I read, and he sort of rings me up from time to time saying, I've reread your second novel. The only person in the world who has done that. And just saying, you know, it's great. It really is great. It's a very funny kind of book. I just thought, you know, I didn't know that. And it's kind of wonderful. You know, I've sort of vaguely become aware as I've grown older of the narrative surrounding unsatisfactory fathers. Fathers who've never approved of you, fathers who've withheld, you know, approval and love, etc. And I sort of, so my father is like the opposite of that. He's it turns out, in retrospect, I met this man who was actually quite distant, I mean, physically distant and emotionally distant when I was growing up, is now this amazing dad, and has been for many years. So he's been a great source of, he's cheering me on from the sidelines, really. Just as when I was a kid, he would, you know, when I was playing sports, he would cheer me on from the sidelines as well.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because I've often bragged that I had this advantage. I didn't have to fight to carve out the role of an artist of some kind. It was sort of a given or a nearby role to assume. It wasn't exotic in my family's life. It was right there. My father went into the studio every day and worked on his paintings, and so if I wanted to do something like that, I had a lot of permission. But because I trained, I went to a special high school, music and art. Now it's been agglomerated with performing arts, and it's LaGuardia at Lincoln Center. But anyway, I painted all through my childhood and teenage years, and went off to college, sort of having shown my portfolio as my qualification for entrance. And so the idea was still very much afloat that I was going to really follow directly. I was thinking about this when you talked about his life of making things. Because it just jumped into my head this one moment before I abandoned painting for writing. And in some ways, it was in the cards. I was much more consumed with reading. I didn't, you know, I go to museums with him, but I identified with writers. I read voraciously. I read biographies of writers. And I was scheming to make this, you know, turn my creative act this other direction. But I still played the role very happily of the prodigy, art prodigy, because it made him happy, and because I had inherited a facility. I kind of had his eye or his hand or whatever it is that, so I could easily impress people. In some ways, it was quicker route to making a good impression than my writing, which was ungainly. And so I liked playing that role. But then in college, I switched. I got away from New York City and from his immediate milieu, and the writing just took over. But there was this one moment. I took a sculpture class at college and announced to him that I wasn't going to paint. I was going to make sculpture. And I came home, and I was drawing, doodling. I remember him looking over with this great sense of kind of interest and approval, and saying, "Those look like a sculptor's drawings now." You know, he really thought he saw something, and this was still enough in his zone. But it also, when you said building, I thought, "Oh, I was going to make something bigger." You know, my dad made these monumental paintings. He was of that generation, mid-century American painters who had to paint a whole museum wall-sized canvas to be serious. So he made very big paintings. But if I made sculpture in three dimensions, especially if I, became David Smith and made giant, like, outdoor steel things, I would make something even bigger. You know, talking about his penis, there I was going to make a bigger thing, right? And then I reverted to make shrinking and making these tiny little cribbed, crabbed little objects of literature. And but he was disconcerted. I'd blown that trumpet loud and hard enough that he was really ready for me to be an art guy. A visual arts guy, and for the first few years, he didn't disapprove, but I could hear him waiting for me to return to the painting. He thought I wandered a little bit, and I was going to come back to it. So he didn't spot that the writing was, in fact, very powerfully continuous with the life I'd lived growing up in his house, and with the kinds of things I'd studied in art school, and the kinds of things I'd absorbed under his parentage. But then he got it. Suddenly, something, he saw some story that I'd written where he both understood that I wasn't going to embarrass myself, that I was going to do this well enough, that it wasn't a terrible thing for me to have chosen, and that it was completely to do with who he was. And then he embraced it, and it became, I just enjoyed, you know, I have always enjoyed since then, this complete, you know, it's talking about his painting and talking about my writing together. It's the greatest thing we share. It's golf. You know, we talk about making impossible things, paintings and novels. You know, and as if it's one thing, really.
One final question, then I'll throw it to the audience for some extra questions. Joe, you're father of three boys. Jonathan, you became a father in 2007. To what extent did that change your writing life, besides probably changing your hours? And I always think of, in some ways, that the thing that sort of signifies a writer is someone who sort of watches himself watching. And I imagine that being a father and being a writer, you could have a lot of meta conversations with yourself about being a father. Or if I wonder if actually just being a father is much more profound than that, and that kind of blows away.
That's a good question. I'm not sure what, there are obviously practical repercussions if you have three boys in 4 years. What effect does it have on your writing? Well, I sort of feel it, I sort of take people slightly more seriously, this is a terrible thing to say, if they have had children already, if they've been through the experience of children. Because I think it does confer a very kind of important experience on you, and so to the extent that one's mind and soul is broadened by having children, and to the extent that a broad mind and soul is important in writing, which it possibly is, I'm not sure actually, and anything involving children, then I suppose it has had an influence on me. I mean, Raymond Carver had the most negative thing to say about this. When asked about his influences, and he wrote a long piece about, you know, he wanted to talk about influences, and he said, and he went on to describe the utter nightmare of being a father to these particular children in the particular circumstances in which he had that experience. I have a much happier experience, but he said that that was the big influence on his life, because it meant he could only write short stories, because his life was fragmented into these tiny portions of leisure or non-parental time or non-family time. I'd like to say something, very soulful and uplifting about my relationship between my creativity and my children, but I don't think I can, really. Other than, I'm just trying to think of something. I can't.
I'm new to this. I don't have your time in, so I hesitate to make any pronouncements. I think it sends me back to that thought about, reaching middle age. I'm kind of an old dad, old new dad. And having a father still living, there's a very simple kind of logistical thing that happens when you have a kid. In the generations, your family, your home becomes the center. You've turned your parents into grandparents. You've altered them in that way, and now they visit you. And there's no question that your home is kind of a center in that way that you recall your home being when you were a child. And up to that point, you still might just as well go visit them on a holiday. And if not sleep, literally in some old bedroom of yours, there's weird stuff around the house that reverts you to childishness. So it's the buck stopping on that kind of reversion. And, I think probably it's obvious in some of my writing, but I was game for reversion for a long time, maybe after I shouldn't have been, and that's just gone.
I think there's actually very little good writing about children anywhere. I mean, it's very hard to find writers writing in interesting detail about their children or about the experience of being with children in a way that is about the children. And I think part of the problem is that so much writing is connected to memory, and it's very hard to remember your children when they're right there in front of you. You can sort of note what they're up to, and you can shove in the odd detail. You think, oh, I need an 8-year-old. My son's an 8-year-old. He likes this. This is the kind of toy he likes to play with. You can kind of exploit your children. But to actually write about them in a way which is kind of as true as the way you would write about adults, I think is just very, very difficult and quite rare.
All right, I'm going to turn it over to the audience. Does anybody have any questions for Joe or Jonathan about fathers or their books or whatever? Yes?
Is it really possible to write truthfully about your father?
Sure, I'll try to deal with that. I mean, Joe alluded to this. Of course, neither of us, we've only had one experience in terms of our fathers. And it may not be any easier, or it'll be a completely different set of problems. But I have had this other extreme, which is that my mother was off the scene well before I tried writing anything. And so from the very first impulse I ever had to write, and long before I understood that I would inevitably be writing autobiographically, whether it was obvious to my reader or not, that the family feeling and memory was going to be everywhere in the work, my mother could not be affected or overhear any of that. And so I've had that freedom. I don't know what it, but again, in such an extreme that it's very hard for me to make any meaningful comparison. She wasn't ever around and then gone. And I only knew her as a child, so it's almost useless. The freedom feels almost, you know, it's like the same freedom we have to write about a myth or a rumor or a movie we once saw. It just doesn't have that same sense of complicated adult responsibility toward another that I feel towards my father. And I think somehow I'm going to still feel quite a long time after he's, you know, knock on wood, passed away. So I'm helpless, really, to answer your question.
I think to write a kind of searching piece of nonfiction while your father is alive about your father, sort of portrait of my father, warts and all, is, I think, practically impossible while they're still around. I mean, it's practically impossible to do that about anybody unless you really hate them. In terms of fiction, you're not really writing about any specific person. You know, you may kind of obviously derive your thoughts and sort of ideas from knowing a particular person, but. I mean, there's no way. I mean, Philip Roth wrote Patrimony after his father died for a very specific reason. You know, he felt able to finally. And actually, when I think about Patrimony, I think that one of the sort of odd things about it is that it describes, for those of you who haven't read it, it describes the illness of his father and then his death, but in such detail that makes you realize that Roth, concurrently with this tragic private experience, was obviously going home every night and making highly detailed notes, which takes a kind of very specific dedication to your work to do that. And he does it without compromising his love for his father, which is extraordinary. But it would require that sort of, you know, that's just an aside. So I think the answer is you can't. I don't think you can until. If then. Wasn't it Proust who said he couldn't write anything until his mother died? Anything. Because he was so worried about her gaze.
Yes?
This is kind of a related question, and Jonathan, you kind of addressed it when you said everybody was sort of fictionalized, and your dad knew that, but you've actually written a memoir, and so when you are writing a memoir, and you're have you had to deal with repercussions of people close to you feeling betrayed or angry or, you know, that your portrayal was not nice or, you know, how have you dealt with that?
Well, the memoir I wrote was a portrait of my grandfather. My grandfathers were both dead, and who I didn't really know. And, of course, those portraits had an impact on their children and on my grandmother, who was alive at the time. But actually, I found that I've spoken to other people who've done the same sort of thing, that if you write about your family in nonfiction terms, it's always a thing you don't expect that causes a problem. You know, like a friend of mine wrote a memoir about his growing up in Zimbabwe. It's a fantastic book, actually. Called Mukiwa by Peter Godwin. And he wrote all sorts of searching and critical things about his parents, but the one thing that they were upset about, it wasn't this sort of overt criticism, it was when he mentioned that he'd been unhappy at school. And they said to him, "What do you mean you were unhappy at school?" And he said, "Well, I was unhappy at school. I was at this boarding school in Zimbabwe or Rhodesia, and I was unhappy there." And they sort of, and that knocked them out. And it made them feel, presumably, that they sort of made some catastrophic decision. Whereas the son saying, "My father is a real asshole," well, you know, the sons would say that anyway. So they can handle that. But in my case, I was actually, there were political issues which divided the response to my book in my family, but not significantly. I think that people are odd, as long as they sense that you're being scrupulous, and you're being as fair as possible, and you're not being sensationalist, that I think that people kind of, as far as I can tell, they're either too polite to say anything, or they actually don't mind it too much. Yeah, that's if they read it.
After Mike Chabon and like Ian McEwan had kids, they came out with young adult literature, like The Daydreamer and Summerland. Would you guys think about going down that similar road?
I've always thought that I wouldn't do that. I don't know why it seemed, and this is no knock on McEwan or Chabon or anyone in particular, but I've always had this feeling of respect, almost like I'd be publishing a book of poetry and how I would imagine the ire of the poets. That I just think children's writing is this discipline taken so totally seriously by those who commit to it, and I wouldn't want to be that dilettante. For me, I'd be afraid of that. As I say, I really am not. And there are lots of instances, of course, of people, writers I admire, those among them who have crossed back and forth. So I always thought it was sort of a barrier that I wasn't interested in going across. Now I'm reading aloud to this not even 2-year-old all the time, and it makes me spin into this space where I'm interested in what the words are doing to him, and so I have found myself helplessly projecting possible, right now, mostly picture books, you know, and weird variations on the picture books we read, because I find myself improving the ones he doesn't like, or noticing where his interest, you know, which pages are the favorite pages, and so I've been changing books a little bit, so much for my reverence for that discipline, right? So now I it's a very incomplete thought, but I have to admit I'm fantasizing about it a little bit. Not like I've got a Summerland hidden in a drawer now that I'm about to unveil, but that it's just, that thought is alive, surprisingly to me.
No.
Into
a page. Now I ask you, can you write your memoir in
6 words? I feel like I already did that. I'm always doing these little tiny requests, and I did trick myself into 6 words, but I could never never remember them or find a different 6 words, I think. So I'm not going to try to do it right in front of you. No.
More than 6 words.
Yeah, it was a long one.
No. Seriously, I just can't do it. I wish I could. I wish I could write a memoir in 6 words. Actually, I'm going to try now. No, I'm not.
Well, I just want to say thank you to Jonathan and Joe for coming out and talking about this. I want to thank everyone for coming. I should tell you that memberships to HousingWorks are $60, and if you become a member tonight, you get a free copy of either one of their books or a copy of Granta, which are available on the front counter. So I should thank Pantheon Vintage for those books. And you can also read more of the Father's Issue in the Granta issue, or you can read online at granta.com. So thanks for coming, and thanks for joining us.